Greetings, dear listeners. I have a special treat for you in store today. By way of introduction, allow me to read a short review I wrote about a decade ago, praising today's guest's seminal work, Four Words for Great Skiing. John Clendenin, recently elected to the Skiing Hall of Fame, is a genius on skis, as he has been since before observers of the ski scene began recording the two-time world champion's exploits. Most geniuses can't communicate their brilliance without abandoning, bludgeoning, or boring their students. Not so Clendenin. In Four Words for Great Skiing, he explains, with extraordinary empathy, the secrets to high-performance skiing. His goal is to give skiers the confidence to explore what he calls the kingdom, the natural, ungroomed terrain where creativity and self-expression reign. His humor, his intelligence, and his gift for communicating mechanics to the non-mechanical shine through every page as if it were backlit. Welcome, dear friend, to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
How can I follow that? You know, I'm afraid to talk now because I don't want to take away from what you said. Oh, Jackson, you're such a treat. You are such a treat. You know,
well, we're going to talk to you about the four words in a few minutes. But let's share with my dear listeners a bit of your backstory. Let's begin at the beginning. Tell us where your ski life began, if you'd be so kind.
Very briefly, I became a speed skater in Plattsburgh, New York. My dad was in the Air Force. We got stationed there, and I took up speed skating. And the first time I skied was at Beartown, a rope tow that's about maybe 50, 60 vertical feet, you know? And I just went nuts. I said, God, you don't have to work. You don't have to work so hard to get speed. And I just loved it. I started skiing, in 1957, I think, was the first time I skied. I got a scholarship to go to Northwood Prep School in Lake Placid and join, you know, a ski racing scholarship. And I'd actually only been skiing, about four or five years at that time. First of all, prep school is not as easy as high school.
Yes.
And having a scholarship, you're supposed
to have a lot of open book tests.
You're supposed to do good in school. Anyway, I got under the tutelage of Warren Witherell, who you're very familiar with, I'm sure, because he was a pioneer in boot fitting and alignment issues and waxing, on top of producing several Olympic team members, Neil Orsi, Rebel Ryan. I mean, we had quite a few. By the way, our team competed against St. Lawrence, Middlebury, and Dartmouth, and we dominated all three of them, our high school ski team. So he corralled.
I mean, it's like having Bill Belichick as your coach. I mean, Warren was ahead of everybody else.
I'm going to share a quick story about Warren, okay? We got to go to Whiteface Mountain twice a week to practice. That was downhill practice, right? We go to Lake Placid Club to practice slalom and GS. But we go to Whiteface, and our primary thing was to practice downhill. And Warren, bless his heart, he'd put us on the ski lift one at a time, and he'd start the clock, and he'd mark down the time we started. And each one, we had 12 guys on the team. Each one of us would go up progressively on the chairlift. And at Whiteface, there's this long chairlift ride kind of up the middle of the run, kind of advanced intermediate terrain underneath. And then you got off halfway up and got on another chairlift that took you to the top of the mountain. And the top of the mountain was quite steep. But there was this run that wandered around kind of the back of the mountain. It was at least 2 miles long. And then you'd make a right-hand turn and go back down the main run, you know, where the lift was, the first lift. And they had a jump built there that if we didn't pre-jump it, you could go like almost 100 feet if you didn't pre-jump it right. Anyway, so we'd get on the lift, go get on the other lift, go up to the top. We'd ski all around this Excelsior. I remember the name of the run. It's about 2 miles long. And you make the turn and come down the mountain and hopefully pre-jump that jump well, because it was kind of scary. And we get to the bottom, and Warren would mark down our time, and then he would let us put on our other ski and do it again. We had to do it on one ski. And I know you know what that has to be like. I mean, it's grueling. So that was our one way of practicing downhill. You had to learn how to ski on each ski very fast.
So like every other elite skier of your era, your pathway to the top inevitably led to racing. racing was the portal to high performance skiing.
I was actually moving up on the team pretty, I was a downhill skier, believe it or not. I was doing well in downhill competitively. And then unfortunately I can't imagine why, but I got caught in a girl's dorm at a ski race. And
you just probably misunderstood the signage.
Yeah, and I didn't have the equipment to do any damage anyway, but I don't know why I was caught under that bed, but they decided, the headmaster said, John, don't get caught doing that stuff, you know? And I said, okay. He said, but we're going to have to take your scholarship away. And that's when my parents decided no more Northwood. I ended up graduating from high school in Clinton, Maryland. And my dad was at Andrews Air Force Base. But anyway, I thought that story about Warren was prophetic, because that's one of the major challenges that he would put in front of us. Again, he produced a couple of Olympians then. And then he went on and formed Burke Academy. And
right. But so you had a great foundation then. You had a great foundation in skills.
I would say that, yeah. I mean, we worked hard. We had to eat fast because we had to get on the bus and go practice every day.
But there goes your life at the private academy. The family then is going to relocate to Southern California. How did you get back on the mythical ski bus from Southern California?
Well, I didn't really. I wanted to be like Paul Newman in The Hustler. I wanted to become a pool shark, right? And that didn't do, I wasn't doing very well at that. It seemed like I left every pool hall broke. But one day I was wandering down Sherman Way one evening at the corner of Sherman Way and Ventura Boulevard, Sherman Way, the corner there is Viking Ski Shop. And I was walking with my pool cue and my empty wallet, and I looked over at the Viking Ski Shop across the street, and there was these lights were glowing in the alleyway, and there was a bunch of people in the alley behind the Viking Ski Shop. I said, what the hell could be going on over there, you know? So I wandered over there, and when I went around the corner to see what everybody was looking at in the back, it was all lit up. I had my mind blown, probably as much as it's ever been blown, when I saw this guy dancing on this giant revolving carpet and making almost ballet moves precisely to Herb Albert's Tijuana Taxi. I went, unbelievable. What? That? Oh. And I had to do it. I wanted to do it. So I had to get up there on this thing because I was still an avid skier. And the guy came down and he said, yeah, son, now what are you doing here? And I said, oh, I want to get on your machine. He said, oh, that's fine. Here, what size feet do you have? I said, 8. He says, oh, I have a pair of size 8 boots. That'll be $50, please. Of course, $50 in 1965 money is probably like about 500 now. You got to be kidding me. I can't do that. I got to do this. Anyway, he ended up letting me. He said, well, then go away. And I didn't. And I said, you can't make me leave. And I was there every night. And finally, he said, okay, good, you can try it. And I skied on it immediately because I'd been watching it so long. And I ended up working for this guy that was 65. And I worked with Phil Girard, who I consider to be in many ways the true father of freestyle, because that's the first time I ever saw entertainment, skiing as entertainment. It's not who could go to A to B the fastest, it's who could entertain the most from A to B. It's my first experience of this new dimension in skiing.
I'll interrupt you just for a moment to remind my dear listeners of just how intricately difficult it is to perform tricks on a carpet that's moving. And if you should err, the carpet moves it's inexorably going to move back to a point where you fall off the backside and the ground is not proximate to where you would fall off the backside.
Well, it's about 9 feet, the one I was on anyway. And I did go over that a few times. We used to play roller derby on the deck where there'd be about 5 of us kids on it. And it was the last one standing,
but survival game. Great.
But anyway, Phil and I went on and did shows together. He ended up hiring me and he was a choreographer from Pajama Game, if you believe that, who was also a ski nut. And he was committed to the idea that you could dance on skis. Okay. And I started learning tricks on the deck and stuff like that. And we ended up doing ski shows. From 1966, we started, and we'd do a show in LA, then San Francisco, then Chicago, then we'd go to Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C.
And these were very well attended consumer shows.
Huge. It's unbelievable how many people would show up at these things.
They make the modern events look anemic.
I know. It's weird. I don't quite understand that one, Jackson. But the shows had thousands of people come to them at that time. Harry Leonard ski shows. Anyway, that was where I learned to do a lot of tricks, and I got back into what I'd call the world of skiing again. It was another vein. It wasn't racing. In 1965, 66, 67, 68, that was really before the idea of freestyle was recognized, before it was born.
Some people would say it was born on the Ridge of Bell. There was one seminal event that caught the spirit of the national zeitgeist and then turned out to have enough energy to carry over and create a competition environment. Would you agree that the legendary Aspen event captured by Barrymore and the performers was a cornerstone event?
It was huge, but there was a bigger one before that.
Explain.
Gotcha. I think the seminal event was, I believe it was in 67. It was a show that was probably, it was probably the biggest promotion that ever has happened for skiing. And that was the 67 Andy Williams Christmas Special, where we had a big deck set up and we had eight dancing girls skiing on the deck behind me as I performed tricks live on television for the Andy Williams Christmas Special. And it was, that show was watched, supposedly, I don't know if we can research it somehow, by like 85% of the people who had TVs watched that show. And if that's true, that was the single biggest promotion of skiing to ever hit the entertainment market.
Well, let's put it another way. This one, this other event was a comp. You ended up with, you know, with winners and losers, and some of the most unbelievable footage you've ever seen, because there was no real way to disqualify. So if
we're talking about Barrymore's event now.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. No. That was by far, I think, that was directed directly towards the ski world. And the performers became, I don't know if anything could go viral then on Super 8 tape machines throughout the whole country. People were watching the performers. And in that event, we staged what I think was the first competitive mogul event. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that event. One, we didn't even have posters for it. It happened literally through word of mouth. And like a few thousand people showed up on the Ridge of Bell to watch this thing. Now, they had more people on the Ridge of Bell than they had at the World Cup. The World Cup was free and at the bottom of the mountain. On the Ridge of Bell, they had to buy a lift ticket to get up to see it. Someone from Basalt called the fire department because they thought there was a fire going on the mountain. Now, why? I don't have no idea. But there was so much smoke in the air that the fire department couldn't figure out a way to get up there anyway. But they had something like 80 contestants show up, and the prize was a pair of skis, a pair of K2 skis. I was one of the performers. We got to forerun it and judge it. By the way, I'm very excited about the fact that the newspaper had one article about it the next day, and they showed my picture forerunning it. That was that's the only proof I have. And I was alive then. But that event, Sid Erickson made a run down that it luckily was caught on the film. Is one of the most spectacular mogul runs I've ever seen. I couldn't believe how fast this guy went down the Ridge of Bell and survived. And very few people did make it without falling.
Right. This is, ladies and gentlemen, these are, they used to call them Volkswagen-sized bumps, and they were not set rhythmically in line with the fall line.
It wasn't much rhyme or reason down those things, yeah. And that was true for basically my whole freestyle history. You know, there wasn't any pattern or anything consistent that you could count on any mogul run we competed on.
So you went from this actually just being a forerunner. It's a very prestigious honor to be the forerunner, but nonetheless, you weren't in that comp. Well, you don't win two freestyle world championships without entering some comps. So when did you transition from sort of a roadie, sort of bouncing around to being on a tour?
You know, an interesting story on my competitive background that I wanted to make sure I could squeeze in here somehow was the fact that, you know, I took the money I'd made from the performers and I was actually on my way to Sun Valley, but I remembered I had a girlfriend in Lake Tahoe. So I made a left-hand turn to Lake Tahoe. It took me 22 years to get to Aspen, but Lake Tahoe. And I had the money I had made from the performers on me. I remember that. And it took me about, 42 hours to lose that $6,000 that I had been paid. I ended up sleeping in a loft someplace. Actually, the girlfriend let me stay in her attic or something. I can't remember how. But I was washing dishes at the Christiana across the parking lot from Heavenly Valley when the Western Regional Freestyle Championships showed up at Heavenly Valley. Now, I was smart enough prior to that that I had met the Holmberg brothers, the Hart owners, and I knew that I was going to compete in freestyle. And they thought, you know, they met me at the ski shows and thought, yeah, maybe this kid has some talent, you know, okay. And I hit him up for Hank Cashewa's prize money, you know, his fee for results. I said, I don't want to be paid anything. Just give me Hank. I knew
his victory schedule.
His victory schedule. I said, just give me his victory schedule. And if I do good, then you do good. Plus I need some skis. So real quickly, Hank's victory schedule was $5,000 for first, $4,000 for second, $3,000 for third, $2,000 for fourth, $1,000 for fifth. Right. I said, if you do well, yeah. You know, I said, it's on TV. You know, I mean, we're going to get all the exposure that he gets too with this thing. So they said, okay. And they took Hank's slalom skis and they actually let me design the color and everything. I said, let's make them purple and say freestyle on the back of them. You probably remember those skis, right?
Yeah.
And they said, okay. And I said, I want a ballet ski. I want to be yellow and say ballet on the back. And they said, okay. So they took Hank's slalom skis and gave me a pair of these purple skis that said freestyle on the back. And here, real quickly, is the results. I won the first event. I won the ballet. I got third in the air and fourth. I don't know. I got a fourth in one of them and a third in the other one. And then I won the overall, right? It adds up to roughly that day with the car I won and the prize money in the purse, about $22,000.
Woo! Okay.
And I looked up what the value of that is today, and that's $133,000 today. So I went from dishwasher, you know, I didn't even care about the checks they gave me. You know, in fact, someone found them in the parking lot and gave it back to me because I knew I just killed it in the victory schedules. And I had a similar one with Solomon also, not for that amount. They were about a third of them, fourth of that amount.
Because they were just bindings after all at the time.
Yeah, they were just bindings at the time, but everybody got in trouble. I know one of the Holmberg brothers, whoever signed the contract with me, that they came back and said, "Now, who is this kid? What do we mean? We owe him $16,000? Are you what?" and then I went on and competed in, the next event was in Vail. And I ended up getting a third overall there with prize money down the line. And then I ended up going to Sun Valley and that's where I won the world championship and got another huge paycheck. So all of a sudden this dishwasher, plus three cars. I won a car.
How well did you manage money now that you had it?
Well, I never have really, you know, conquered that task well, honestly. Believe me, when you're in the middle 70s in Lake Tahoe, it was pretty much a fantasy life.
Were you still living in Tahoe when you won your second world championship?
Yeah. And by the way, I set up a freestyle training center on the lake, Zephyr Cove, and we had two of the big decks side by side, and we had two big water jumps, two trampolines that we built into the sand, so you're jumping on ground level. And believe it or not, we had a 12-page article in Sports Illustrated come out. ABC, NBC, and CBS all came out and did various things that exposed our training center. It was hugely successful. And I don't want to get into what happened to it. I just can't believe it. I had a partner that ended up taking it all apart while I was in Europe doing a Marvel tour and moving it to the parking lot at Heavenly Valley because he made a deal with the owner of Heavenly Valley. And it lasted 1 year there because it was so much dirt from the parking lot that the deck didn't work and the jumps didn't work. So it lasted 1 year. I ended up taking him to court, suing him and won for stealing partnership property.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the carpet's about to get pulled out from under freestyle skiing in this country. The litigation in the ski industry, I know from I was at Salomon at the time, where we were sued between 400 and 600 times a year over various skiing injuries, because everyone just naturally assumed if you were injured, something must be wrong with the bindings. So we were named constantly. So we have a highly litigious society. The NSAA, National Ski Areas Association, runs SCARED and issues an edict that their membership are not allowed to promote or otherwise allow in any way inverted aerials. They weren't going to lose their insurance if they were to indulge the current passion for going upside down in the air that was part of freestyle competition. And as a result of that, the Professional Freestyle Association moved to Europe.
I've got a little piece of information about that I could interject right now. What's interesting is we had executives in the ski business coming into our ski areas in advance and building the jumps. And they were actually making fairly decent lips on these jumps, but the landing started right after the lip of the jump. And this is what happened to me. I out-jumped them all because I wasn't an acrobat, but I had to jump high and far to place with in the overall. I actually knocked myself out twice with perfect landings. Seriously, I broke my jaw because I turned my head as I slammed in my knee. And evidently I stood up nice and straight and I got a perfect score on the landing. But I fell over about 20 feet further and I woke up in the infirmary, a snowbird. The point being is they weren't making jumps right. Now this is an interesting segue. When I did a film for Barrymore before the performers, it was called the Bonnie Bell Ski Film, and we did it at Aspen Highlands. And Aspen Highlands has this restaurant up on the mountain, and it is absolutely a perfect jump. It has a nice steep end run. Then you have a flat entry to the jump, and then you build your lip right next to the balcony, the porch of the restaurant, which is about 30 feet long. And it's really steep on the other end of the porch, right? So it was a perfect lip and jump for the way a jump should be made.
Right.
Now, we formed a committee after Scotty Magrino got hurt at Vail. We formed that's when IFSA got born. We formed a committee, 50 of us signed it, that we weren't going to jump anymore unless we made the jumps. Okay. We had a committee of five competitors who would go in advance and they would build the jumps. We never had an injury after that. It took three to 4 years for those cases with Magrino and
Peter Hirshhorn.
Steamboat. It took 3 or 4 years for those cases to go through court. In that 3 or 4 years, we never had an injury after that. Okay. And then it came to litigation and the ski industry lost and they decided, oh no, we're not going to allow inverters anymore. And of course, that took the balls out of freestyle because that's what television wanted. The aerials had gotten very exciting. Television wasn't interested in watching us do uprights. So we lost all, the bottom fell out of the value of freestyle for commercial use.
In this now, country, but your organization would more or less pick up stakes.
Amateur event. It got born again as an amateur event in Europe and in Canada. And they built the jumps right. And they did do inverteds. And it came back to this country as an amateur event, I believe. You know, I didn't follow. I was out of it by then.
Did you join the European tour? Did you make that transition?
I went on the Marlboro tour. I don't know if you remember that. It was, they took five of us throughout Europe and we performed. And I even went to Iran, which is a great place. Partied with the Shah.
So what did your competition career then just sort of peter out?
Pretty much. Yeah. That's kind of when I became a golf pro.
Before we get into your golf side, we can certainly return to that because there's some interesting points to be made there. If we sort of compress this middle period, when we spit you out the other end of a incubation here, you come out with a complete learn-to-ski methodology. You and I had talked a long time ago about your goals in this area, but that was before you'd written word one and before you'd really, I think, conceived the four words. Well, I'll give you a sort of transition to this and then throw the thoughts back over to you. Your best event, the one result that you could count on that lifted you into gold medal position in the combined was your ballet results. Now, most people in America.
That was my back experience, I think, yeah, from a lot that it directly translated from my carpet, you know, like all the time I spent on the carpet, because it's harder to do tricks on a carpet than it is on snow.
As a point I was trying to make earlier, you make a mistake on a carpet, you suddenly are flying towards the pavement. I would allege that it's this very facility in what has become an arcane and now unknown event, ballet or acro, as they later on tried to call it in an attempt, ultimately failed attempt to revive it. It must have informed your creation of the four words, which, by the way, dear listeners, are drift, center, touch, and tip. And we can revisit those points because we're blazing past them right now. But those four points, I don't think would be the same four points maybe if you weren't as skilled as you are at edge transitioning and managing a flat ski that ballet absolutely requires. And you might not thinking of managing a flat ski as important for skills development. Isn't it all about edging skis? Yeah, it's also about drift. The number one turn here, thing here, is drift, not edge. Drift, that's where it starts. Talk to me.
Job about at marketing. I like the way you're going at this, Jackson. I think I can use you. Sounds good, my man.
I have a decent track record in the marketing department. talk about those four words and how they are both all at once and a continuum. They're a series of motions, but they're ultimately about flow. They're ultimately about not segmenting them, but unifying them. They're sequential. So you have something, if you don't know them, you have a learning sequence to learn. But when you put it all together, it's fluid.
You know, first of all, yes, you're probably right that the ballet probably was significant in my was prominent in my decision to make it as simple as possible. You know, I really believe in what Einstein said: if you can't explain your subject simply, you don't know it. Okay, my whole effort with Clendenin method CM, my whole effort with the method is to make it accessible as simply as possible. It is open-ended. We have a group. One of the aspects of it that's so important is that my group of coaches are all versed in the method so that we can give, I can work with one student for a couple of days and I can hand him off to one of my coaches and we explain exactly where they are in the process. So the other coach picks that person up and can carry that on. Now, that doesn't happen in the ski industry very well. If someone's taken a lesson over in Vail and they have a good instructor and they come over to Aspen and they get another good instructor, a lot of times they don't get information that is associated with the other lesson. You know, it's just they feel a little bit confused about it because it's they pick up at a completely different spot, which doesn't mean it's all bad. It just makes it a challenge. Whereas the idea of the Clendenin method, if you get involved in the program, you stick with it. Okay, you stick with it. If any of the coaches come up with something that makes it simpler, makes it safer, makes someone feel more confident, any way of phrasing something or any technical issue that could be brought to bear, we'll endorse as a group. But before it gets endorsed, we go through it as a team. We go through it as a team. So we all are on the same page when we get to it. Now, the four words, drift, center, touch, tip, are all reference points in a turn. And each one of them has a blog, by the way, on my website. You know, you can read about each one of these words in depth.
Let's give that website name right now for our dear listeners.
Okay. The easiest way to get to it is skimethod.com. Okay. One word, skimethod.com. Okay? Okay. And that'll lead you to the website. But drift, for instance, it's what I define as what you do between pole touches. Okay? With intention. Intention is the key word for the meaning of drift. And it can be something where you slip partially down the hill and go across and get the speed managed to the degree you want. You know, it's amazing, Jackson. When I teach people how to side slip, that's one of the first things we do. They go, are we allowed to do this? I mean, is this something you're allowed to do? Well, it's probably one of the key skills in being able to ski bumps, for Christ's sakes. If you can't slip between them, you're going to die. And they go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So the idea of what you do between a turn, even if it's transitioning down the hill and then back up, is a drift if it's done with intention. Okay. Now, center is basically meaning you want to be working with both your feet. You want to feel what your feet are doing. And feet are primary in my method, as you know. You know, I really believe that 90% of great skiing happens in the feet.
Yeah, that may sound obvious, dear listeners, but let that sink in a little bit. You don't ski with your hips or your knees or your eyes or your hands as much as you ski with your feet.
Cringe when I hear, and I do hear, instructors talking about where you're supposed to put your body. Okay, your feet will guide your body. Your body will go to where it's most comfortable over your feet. So let your feet be the boss. And people have a challenge with that. And we spend a lot of time in that initially with all our clients. Let's just ski and feel what our feet are doing. I don't care whether it's good or bad, but feel your feet. Become aware of what your feet are doing. And then we progress from there. Now, what I've never understood is why people can't relate to the touch as the release point. You know, I mean, that's one of the contentions I have with PSI. It's so clear to me that when you touch, that cues the release into a new turn. And that's where the tipping word comes. In other words, I would say touch release, but I like tipping better, you know, because Cal Cantrell taught me that. He says, you know, tipping isn't a town in China, for Christ's sakes. Where's your money? You know, so I like the word tip. And that basically is the release move into the new turn. Now, another
thing. By the way, dear listeners, I should point out that we're not talking about turns on a placid, totally groomed corduroy beach. There are methods that focus particularly on ultra prepared terrain. We're talking about ultra non prepared terrain. We're talking about getting off of the groomer and getting into what John, I think, so beautifully calls the kingdom. Because that really describes, I think, the sort of magical portal that you pass through when you go into untamed off-trail conditions, because that's really the home of creativity and freedom.
Jackson, you know, not to oppose that thought in any way, but we do spend quite a bit of time on groomed teaching the keys to the kingdom, what I call the keys to the kingdom. One of the facts of what we have run across, or what I've run across in my 22 years developing this thing, is the fact that most people hang out on their downhill ski on an aggressive edge and then step out with the top ski, especially when they get into terrain, into varying terrain. You see that stem move is almost, well, I'd say it's somewhere around between 95 and 99% of all my clients have that habit. I don't know if you've ever seen a kid learn to ice skate or rollerblade. Their feet are way out and their knees are together. That's a natural instinct, is to be on the big toe side of the body. To learn how to use the uphill edge, or the what I call the epiphany pad, that's the feeling in the top foot, a feeling balance in that top foot. All great skiers go to that epiphany pad to make their next turn. If you watch Stenmark, for instance, used to jam that uphill foot into the snow and then make his next turn and pick up the inside ski and jam it in again before he made his next turn. And I've got slow motion shots of Keeley doing it on every turn. And I'm just telling people, we've got to learn about this other ski. We've got to learn about all the functions related to this other ski.
I characterize this, dear listeners, as tricking the student by using this terminology into waiting the downhill ski while it's still the uphill ski.
Yes. And thank you, because anyway, that is a huge, huge part of our what we work on with the keys to the kingdom. I tell people, if you can't do it down here on the groom, you sure as hell aren't going to be able to do it up there in the bumps. So let's get it here. You keep doing the same thing over and over again up there, you're not going to change anything. Come on, come on.
What do you see as the classic hang-up of the student who comes to you, the most typical? And when does the breakthrough happen? When does the aha?
You know, the biggest key to the kingdom, and the one that gets the most results, is the one we work on first, because it's basically the simplest. And that's the one where we try to get people. Well, we don't try. We do. We, you know, if they don't get this, they don't get to go beyond it. And that's being able to slip down a corridor, managing their speed with their top foot, managing their feet with their feel of it with the top ski. Most of them don't have any feeling or a balance in that top foot. Now, you know, I can't really stand you up right now because you're on a TV screen. But if you stood up, if you were waiting for a cab in New York, you'd kind of kick your hip over to one side and you would rest against the upper foot. You wouldn't turn a knee into the middle of your body and stand on a flexed leg. You would stand on the outside ski because that's where the bone structure is. It goes right up the ankle, into the femur, up the body, up the chest. The epiphany pad is a much, much stronger position than bending the knee on the big toe edge, because that's all ligaments and tendons and muscles. So when people learn how to use both their feet, they actually have more balance. They actually have more stability. And we, you know, we talked about fear a little bit, you know, when you mentioned that. I don't know if you're going to like this or not, because I tell people, if you're afraid, you should be.
That's fine. It's an early warning signal for us.
Yeah, no, that's a good sign. And I would honor that. I said, it'll go away when you really learn how to ski, when you learn what you're doing. I have people come to me all the time, say, John, I don't know why that run scared me. It's a piece of cake now. They feel much safer. They feel much stronger. They're less tired when they learn how to use both feet. You know, you watch guys like Mike Rogan ski. I mean, he's such a beautiful skier.
Isn't he exquisite? But it's not just that it's a classical form, because you can not only tell this is a guy who's skiing well, you can tell it's Rogan.
Well, yeah. there's Mike. But he uses both his feet so limberly. I mean, he's got great balance, and it's one of the facets that's so enjoyable to watch in any great skier. So many of our clients are way too dominant on their big toe edge, and they hold on to that way too long, and the only option they have to make a turn is to step out and step onto another.
In their defense, isn't that what they've been taught, however, by others, is how to quote unquote do it?
Unfortunately, yes. I don't think there's enough attention put in that area. Although now they're studying Michaela, for instance. She dominated, I think, because of the way she was using her inside ski, and they're discovering that. So are all the other racers too. So she's having a little more trouble standing out. One of the things she practiced, there's YouTube videos of her practicing on her uphill inside ski a lot.
Let's go back to something you mentioned a moment ago, that when your professional career as a competitor was closing, another door was opening. You went aggressively at your golf career. And let's talk a little. So you become you've been a lifelong virtually PGA and PSIA member. You know the methodologies both of those organizations promulgate, but there are nonetheless differences between them. Talk about parallels that they're very similar and ways in which they're different between your experience growing both of those sports.
The most prominent similarity is the fact that there's about 27,000 members in each organization. Okay. There's approximately 27,000 members. It might be 28 now. I'm not sure. The PGA certification system is much more complex, and it takes a lot more commitment. Just as a quick example, one of the requirements is that you get 30 credits. The only way you get one credit is to work for 1 month under a Class A pro. Hmm. So that's a 30-month commitment to being under a Class A guy, right? And then you have the player's ability test, which is you have to have a certain score playing 36 holes. And I made it by 2 shots the first time I tried it. There was 32 people at Edgewood trying to qualify for it. And my buddy and I were the only two that passed it. And we were the only two taking it for the first time.
Wow. Was he also a skier?
No. Jim Cochran. He's a big boy. He shot like a 66, 72. And all you had to do was to have two rounds that total was under 160, under 80 a round. My total was 158, I think. I just made it. Anyway, but once you get that, that's you're in. You know, you're in for as long as you pay your dues and maintain your credits, which is you have to keep doing stuff as a member, you know, like working on junior golf events and continue to work in the golf business at some level, commitment at some level. But anyway, the number of members is probably where the similarities end. To pass the PGA certification, you have to go through two test periods. And in those test periods, they do the club fitting. You have to know the mechanics of the golf swing, the physics of the golf swing. You have to learn how to fold shirts. You have to learn how to run a cash register. You have to run a starter's desk. You have to teach a junior golf program. I mean, on all these things you get tested on, right? So it's pretty demanding. It took me 3 years at Incline to get my 30 months in. They gave me extra credit for the months that I was actually in between. But, you know, anyway,
Which sport's harder to teach somebody?
I honestly believe that skiing's a snap if you open your mind and open up to the feelings that are available to it. Golf, as you well know, sucks. I mean, there's so many different parts of the body that are coordinated in a golf swing, and it changes as you age. But before I got into the golf business, I was like about a three because I played in college. I played competitively. My dad was in the Air Force, and every place we went, I played golf all the time and had great lessons. I mean, I had great coaches in my golf as growing up as a golfer. Now I'm about 11.
The evolution isn't exactly gone in the right direction.
No, but I don't have the time that I would like to spend on it. Plus, I've been kind of working on one foot mainly, so it's been a little bit of a challenge. But anyway, I'm a golf addict. I still love it. You know how much fun it is to go out with some guys and play a round of golf.
I've seen some videos of you playing rounds of golf with your friends. You're having a lot more fun than just golf, it seems like.
Those videos, yeah. But you're a golfer now, wouldn't you?
I am. In fact, I just went through something very edifying. I finally said, you know, I'm getting worse at this, not better. Part of it is that I have a prestigious collection of vintage clubs going back to the Grover Cleveland's, I think, second administration. So they're
great ancient
things. So I said, I need new tools, but it won't do me any good to get new tools if I don't learn how to use them. So I've spent a lot of time researching who is the best instructor in this fair town of Reno. I found him. By the way, his name is Chris Trevino, and he's extraordinary. It turns out, upon not even very scrupulous examination, that everything I was doing was wrong. There was nothing to be saved. From my ball position to my grip to my takeaway to my swing thoughts to my swing itself, which was catastrophic, shredded. We had to throw the whole kit and caboodle out. But as a result, I now have a golf swing and I have a reasonably good idea of where the hell it's going. I don't lose my ball anymore. I used to have to take 27 balls out for a round because I Sierra Sage, a lot of them went in the sage.
One simple question. Have you broken 90 yet?
Yes, I would break 90 if we don't. I was trying to not make score the goal. I was trying
to. I was just wondering if you can't break 90 unless you know the game. You can't do it unless you know the game.
But it was very interesting and to realize how, in fact, difficult it is to relearn something when you've been coaching your body all along, do something quite different. Yeah. That was quite incorrect.
Yeah. See, reasons I think skiing is a bit easier is because it deals with larger muscle groups and larger bone structure. And in golf, there's so many little intricacies that can complicate it. And any one of them could kind of throw you off. But I want to mention one other thing about the difference between the PGA and the PSIA, okay? And this is something I struggle with. And that's that the golf industry, Professional Golfers of America, really endorse their key markets, their key teachers, and they allow for them to develop their methods. They go, one of the processes to get your certification is you have to understand the physics of the golf swing. And they trust their you know, the famous ones, Butch Harmon is probably the most famous, but David Ledbetter, Hank Haney. I mean, there's a plethora of very qualified coaches who have their own method. You actually go and check in to Hank Haney's down in Texas, Dallas, Texas. He has a big barn. You have to, you stay there for a week, you know, when you go through his method. And again, the analogy that I gave you earlier is that Butch Harmon came to Aspen. If he came to our private club, the private club would go, "Oh, Butch, can our members join your group? Are you okay with our members joining you? I mean, do you need a place to stay? We'll take care of you." Frankly, I've struggled with the idea of having my own method in skiing, but at least I have enough of the basic mechanics. My lexicon, my unique lexicon does refer to sound fundamentals. And I think someone like Mike Rogan understands that because my skiers are skiing really well. They are going on the whole mountain and they weren't able to before. And so the results are there. But, you know, I have this PS guy saying, "What do you mean? What is this love spot? What are you talking about? You know, what is this cascading? How, you know, why, you know, this doesn't, we don't know these words." And I go, "Well, take my camp. You will know."
Right. So in other words, what this is driving at somewhat, dear listeners, is that in this country, the ski area owns the ski school, and thou shalt only take lessons from thy mountain ski school. This is not what goes on, for example, in Europe, where independent operators are free to conduct their ski school, you know, the Rudy so-and-so ski school, shall we say, in Kitzbühel. Even though Kitzbühel may have their own ski school, they are not the only ski school on the mountain.
There's 12 in Kitzbühel. There's 14 in, I'm going to Val d'Isère. I'm taking a group to Val d'Isère in March. By the way, good people, there's a couple rooms left in our block. It's kind of insurance driven in some way that I don't quite understand, but evidently the industry offers insurance deals if you have a PSIA affiliation. I don't know if you remember Les Otten, what he did at Sunday River.
I certainly remember Les Otten.
Les Otten formed his own ski school, the Perfect Turn Ski School. You didn't have to be PSIA. It wasn't a PSIA ski school, but he's one of the few examples of someone who kind of stepped outside of the PSA. Now, I don't know how he did it or what his insurance issues are because he did that. He's no longer in the ski business, I don't think. There's some sort of affiliation between the PSI and the insurance. I don't quite understand that yet, but I have talked to some litigators that litigate in the Supreme Court area level, and they said, you know, I don't know how they get away with that they don't allow other ski schools or other teachers to work on their mountain. If you buy a lift ticket, you should be able to. I'm not going to argue that, though. I'm perfectly happy here in Aspen. I actually love it. Love the school supports me, and it's wonderful. When I go to Europe, Portillo, Mike Rogan endorses my program also.
Let's talk a little bit about more what other tools you have for people who are wanting to improve their skiing. You have obviously your camps, ladies and gentlemen. There's a series of camps. What do you have in store this year?
How do I put this? Monday through Friday, I have a 3-day camp, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, which I call the fundamental camp. And then Thursday, Friday, I have what I call a graduate camp. You have to have graduated to be in the graduate camp, right? I've sold out my December camp. I have a few openings, I guess, in the fundamental, in the 3-day, the beginning. But the graduate camp is sold out in December. In January, we're about 3/4 of the way sold out. And then February and March are still open. What we do is we do that same week process in all 4 months, right? All 4 of those months. And also at the end of March, we take a group to Val d'Isère. And I go to this fabulous hotel with a spa that even men like to go to. Val d'Isère is where I met Keeley. I got to ski with him a little bit. And I went, "Oh my God, this guy's amazing." And by the way, the method is really based on watching Jean-Claude, not only skiing with him, but seeing his video, studied it. I looked at it 1,000 times. And I still think he's one of the most beautiful free skiers that we've ever had.
What other tools do you offer skiers? You have your camps and the wonderful one-on-one on snow instruction that goes on there. But aren't there some other components of your site that are accessible to the public? Things like a Tough Love Library or other two other things that they can see to get an idea of how your program works in action?
Well, one, we have the simulator. I have a simulator set up so that they can come and do the indoor simulator, which people just learn real quick on it because you can't fall. So they're willing to experiment a little bit on it. And if you can do it on the simulator, believe me, you can do it on snow. And we have them in a belt, a safety harness, so they can't fall. And they're a little bit freer to try stuff and experiment with feelings. I have the book. Right? The book expresses everything in the lexicon that's kind of unique. By the way, I'd like to take words out of their lesson past. And I have my set of words because I don't want them trying to put their square notions into my round pegs, you know? That helps. If you come and do a camp, you can do what I call a tough love. People say, John, what do you call it a tough love? I go, because it is tough love. In the tough love, we show people what's constructive about what they're doing and what they need to work on. So we take two shots. We take a shot of them ungroomed, and we take a shot of them skiing and a little bit, you know, whatever level they're at, terrain, including bumps. And we point out the next process that they should be focused on to go to another level in the video. And what's interesting, if you go on my website and you join it, you can see that I've done over 120 of these, where I've analyzed people using our method. When people get one of them, they want to get four of them. I mean, they want to do one every time they come. It's really great. It's a great marketing ploy. But these things take time. Logistical, it's kind of a problem because you have to shoot them. Then you have to post it on the website. Then you have to pick the pictures. Then I have to analyze them. Then it goes back into iMovie. And then it gets published on our website. It's a process. So they're not real simple. But I've got over 100 of them. Go watch them if you want. I've got some on, anybody can see them on our skimethod.com site.
Great. Skimethod.com.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Remember that, dear listeners. Just to cross-fertilize this conversation a little bit, you were very kind in praising a book I wrote called Snowbird Secrets, which goes about the business of teaching people about skiing in a completely different way. I certainly don't step on the toes of anybody whose goal is a more coherent form of instruction than this highly anecdotal sort of aphoristic way of trying to teach people how to reconnect with the mountain. But
would you read what I said, Jackson? Because I want him to know I didn't have to use a dictionary for that. Often when we talk to you, we do need one.
What John wrote and as cited on the back cover of Snowbird Secrets is that Secrets is really about flowing into the zone, be it the athletic performance zone or the zone of life. It should be required reading for all students and their instructors.
Definitely a great book. Yeah. And thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your endorsement. You mentioned that your program has to deal with fear. One of the reasons people come to the program is to manage their access to this more challenging terrain without fear blocking their development. Have you ever heard of fear of high lifts? Have you ever heard of this phenomenon? I just discovered that it had an acronym, fear of high lifts, FOHL. And since I've called it out to my readers, I've had dozens of people send me notes saying, yeah, I've had this for a long time. Maybe not their whole life. Sometimes it only comes with age. But they always thought they were alone. They always thought I was the crazy one. And well, don't tell my friends. They'll think I'm a nut. And it turns out a lot of people actually have this. Perhaps it's a form of fear of heights, but it's specifically in this context tied to fear of high lifts. Ever encounter that or hear of that?
I have it. I have it. I am terrified. I mean, there's a couple of gondolas over in Val d'Isère that you can ride up to go over to Italy, and it's just scary as hell. It goes straight up, and it just terrifies me. One of the things I felt safer in my hang glider often than I did in a chairlift. And I think one of the aspects of it is you don't have control. There's a control factor you don't have in a lift. You're dependent on other people. Whereas my hang glider, if I screwed up, at least it was my fault. You know, and I did a couple of times. but I never felt that fear of heights going down to the gun barrel at Heavenly. You know, I was 500 feet in the air there. But riding up on their little chairlift, I felt it. Now, how to explain that? I don't know. I think it has something to do with control.
A couple more points before I let you go. The great Greg Stump is working on yet another way of trying to capture the history of freestyle skiing And yep. you have begun a small collaboration with him by at least providing him with some footage of some work that you had done that goes back to the day. Is it fun for you to keep sort of revisiting this whole amazing period of life? Because the birth of freestyle in this country was unlike anything else that had ever happened in skiing before. It was the first time that there was a way of getting down the mountain and being judged on it by something other than the clock. And it was judged on style. Those two words, free style, while it's what it has meant on the slope has varied a great deal over the last 40 years, what it has meant in spirit has been exactly the same. Break bounds, total freedom. Do you feel any sort of sense of having contributed to the birth of this incredible and enduring movement?
You know, I think there's several words that relate to the idea that it's more than just who can get between A and B the fastest, which, by the way, is the simplest way to judge people. But the fact that a lot of what freestyle is about, for me anyway, is also excitement. You know, people want to be entertained or excited by what goes on between A and B, point A and point B. That does fascinate me. I mean, it is part of the fascinating part of it. You know, God, I don't know how to broach this, but what you see going on today with slopestyle and all the incredible things that these young people are doing now is mind-blowing. The one aspect about it that is, I think, leveling out a little bit is they are near the limit, what they can and can't do. They're going to stop letting them go any further or any higher pretty soon. You know, it's already happened in the half pipe with people. Major, major injuries have happened in that. So I think what we're seeing is not the max, but, you know, it's hard to tell what they're doing in the aerials now. They're flipping around so fast and twisting around. You go, I don't know whether he did three or five of them. I can't tell. But what was exciting about our era that was special about it is we were developing that. We were discovering that. We were in the process of experimenting with what the limits were as we progressed. And that made it so exciting. I think that's what brought it, brought all the attention to it. Unfortunately, I don't see that today. You know, they say, oh, he did a half drop, double twist, I don't know what all that is anymore. Whereas, you know, I remember seeing the first half in, half out double flip. I was on a T-bar going up Spruce Peak at Stowe. And I looked over and I saw this guy do the first double flip with a half twist on one and a half twist on the other. I literally fell out of the T-bar. I fell off the T-bar. Oh, my God. And that was just such a thrill. Anyway, what are we talking about? I forgot.
We're just talking about we've gone through several eras of freestyle. We went through the birth. We went through the transfer to Europe and the death of it in America. We saw it come back finally. And then we saw it morph into something completely different called slopestyle and big air and even big mountain skiing to some degree is an offshoot of that same tree. What you began as the first sort of middle finger raised in the air against the Racing Academy has now become all sorts of different deviations. That sort of broke the dominance of racing and resulted in a fragmentation where we now have, you know, the entire backcountry world. It's its own thing and its own elements of risk, ethos, if you will. It freed us to look at skiing in a much more open way and allowed all these different forms of expression to evolve. You may say maybe they're kind of reaching the limit of the spectacle of the evolution. What it really shows is that skiing allows for a good athlete a phenomenal range of creative involvement.
Right. God, I hate to digress into this, but one of the true motivations that I still have is when I see someone just get a shitty grin on their face because they just skied something they've never skied before and felt good about it. I honestly am motivated by that, by what the method is doing, you know, for the general public on a very basic level. All of a sudden, they feel safer, they feel less tired, they feel more balanced in their skiing places they've never skied before. And I have to get that thrill vicariously because, Jackson, you know, I mean, I remember going down Snowbird, there was a freaking helicopter in the air filming it, and we had loud Rolling Stone music going on both sides of the run with 3,000 people screaming and yelling while you're going down. And I ended up biting the sides of my tongue off because I was so thrilled to death. I'm spitting blood out at the bottom going, God, that was the most exciting thing I've ever done. I haven't come close to that since then. I don't have that jubilation from going out and going skiing right now. You know, I've been a little bit limited lately. I've had a couple, like I say, I've been working on this ankle thing, you know, that I'm getting over. But
yeah, dear listeners, John's feet are a hot mess. No, he's been in the process of rebuilding himself from the ground
up. It's not my fault. Oh, they're recovering enough to at least play golf. I can still ski, perfectly able to ski with my clients and do all the Keys to the Kingdom. So I found my thrill in the vicarious experience of seeing people just get so damn excited about, you know, a new level that they're going to. Now, we have the X Games here, and it is just wild, you know. I mean, unfortunately, it scares me because it gets so crowded. I get out of town when they get here. It's such a... But watching it on TV, I still go, oh my God, these kids are just absolutely incredible what they're doing.
Well, you can't recapture that in your own body for sure, but your true legacy is what you've done with the Four Words of Great Skiing. I mean, you've left behind something which is more valuable than the ephemera of your competition achievements and have provided a lasting and enduring value. I mean, I think it stood the test of time. How many years have you been doing this now?
Well, I came here in 95, and that's when I had a ski deck, and I started doing lessons. And I thought, you know, John, you really got to find a niche for yourself here, buddy. You know, I mean, you're going to try to make a living doing this now again. Well, let's figure it out. I said, let me think. Oh, that's right. I won a couple world championships in freestyle. Why don't I do something with moguls? Well, what can I do with moguls? Well, not many people like to ski them that much, but maybe there's some that would like to. So basically, I started a program that introduced people to skiing the whole mountain and not the groomed highways, and it took off. And now, honestly, I found that there's a huge market there, Jackson. A lot of people really do want to get off the groomed runs, but they feel they just look so bad and they look like monkeys. They don't want to look like that when they go off piste. So.
If you want to look your best, dear listeners, I have a very simple suggestion. Sign up for a Clendenin camp. He's not just a genius on skis. He is a genius at communicating skiing, and that is more precious than mere skill. I want to thank you again, John Clendenin, two-time world champion, U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame member, richly deserved. Thank you for being such a dear, dear friend. You and I have had some great moments, like at a induction. It was another Hall of Fame event, I think, where I bought 87 shots of tequila and put it on skiing's bill while you and I sat against a back wall telling each other stories.
Jackson, we were under the table. We got under a couple tables. But anyway, Jackson, I want to tell everybody, you know, you are a genius, and you're someone we all look up to. And I'm so proud of you for doing what you're doing. And it's just... It's ingratiating for all of us to be associated with your brilliance. I mean, it's amazing, and I just want you to know that I and everybody I know appreciates it.
Thank you so much, JC. Those are very touching words. Dear listeners, I'll be back with you next week for another edition of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.